All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian and anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're again talking about Hotel Rwanda. And I say again because we attempted to do a recording last night, and we ran into some internet problems. And so we are going for a second try here tonight. So there's plenty of bonus content available for everyone. If you hit up our actualanarchy.com/Patreon, you got an hour and 16 minutes of our failed attempt yesterday. Also with some juicy pre-show content, and also our original open where I grilled Robert on some very uncomfortable questions. So if you want to get a hold of that, you know where to go, our Patreon. And where to go for this episode's show notes is actualanarchy.com/199. This is the 199th running of the Bulls of the Actual Anarchy Dude Bros, and my co-host is Robert. And I'm going to say hello to you now, Robert. How you doing there, buddy?
Well, that's the perfect time to do it, buddy. Yeah. Hi, how you doing? I'm doing all right. You're looking good. Looking real sexy.
Well, thank you kindly. Thank you for that. And why don't we just get an update from you on how work's going? I understand you had a recent marketing event that we discussed yesterday on the pre-show stuff. We're actually in the now bonus content. So I'm not going to reiterate what that is per se, but let's talk about the downstream effects. Has it been increasing business? And is this something that is a strategy that you guys will continue to use going forward?
Most likely. Yeah, I think it is a long-term winning strategy, especially in these parts. People over here in this very fire-heavy area, it's very dry, very crispy, very fire-prone, and very poorly forest-managed area. So we heavily rely on firefighting services. So they are highly appreciated. I mean, if one public sector fumbles the ball, you know, you're angry at those people. But then when some other guy in the public sector picks it up and runs with it, you're like, oh, okay, well, thanks for that. Takes it in for a touchdown. You're like, okay, all right. I guess I can kind of get on board, even though the guy that fumbled it's an asshat. You got to pick it up and run with it. You know, I like that guy a little bit. And like we were saying before, you know, it's still a job that would exist in a free market. And even though you'd probably subscribe to it, much like a Netflix account, or it might be a part of the purchase in your HOA or any number of ways it could get done, or it might be still be a volunteer. You don't know, but that's the beauty of the market. We'd figure out the best way. But for the business, it's been, I mean, it's short lived. We've only done it one day. And it's only for this week, but we have had a very strong response on social media from it. And we've already had people that have donated to us just because we've offered this service for free to these people. They've already donated to us and more than covered the costs involved. And that wasn't our intention. Our intention was strictly to do a kind of a thank you thing. And of course, you know, we're announcing it. So we are looking for a little bit of accolades. I mean, you can't think of anybody that does this on the down low. I mean, there are some people that do this kind of thing anonymously, but we are a business, and you know, we're looking to give back to the company and or to the community. And we're not going to be completely silent. We have to get the word out somehow, right? Or else there nobody's going to know to come in. So it's just kind of a win-win for everybody.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me of that episode of Friends. I'm really going to date myself here, but where Phoebe was saying that no act can be truly like, not selfish,
you know, so thing like, is an unselfish act. Yeah.
Right. And then I like how you mentioned that the service should be treated like Netflix. So that means you could cancel it if you didn't want to have the service anymore. Like I just did with Netflix. I feel like I'm expressing my virtue. I'm virtue signaling to the the non-Cuties fans out in the world by doing that.
Yes, yes, you are. Although, you know, rightfully so. I mean, if they, you're expressing your dissatisfaction with a service and you have every right to do so and to not support them with your cash dollars. I mean, maybe they'll turn it around. You'll get, they'll get the market signal and they'll come. I heard they've lost something like over $9 million in market cap just from stock loss in one day. I don't know if it's continuing. I think it's still continuing, but it's they've definitely gotten the signal.
I think it's actually going to come about. I think you're off by an order of magnitude. I think it's 9 billion with a B.
Oh, that's what I meant to say. Is that, what did I say? Million?
Million. That's pocket change.
That is pocket change. Yeah, you're right. It was billion in one day. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we could use the pocket change in our Patreon coffers if you guys want to give up some of that. So actualanarchy.com/Patreon. Hit us up over there. And we're going to get into the last narrative portion of the show, introduce our guest, and have a discussion on Hotel Rwanda right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood, and my co-host is Robert Paul Johnson. We are The Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Check it out at thelaunchpadmedia.com. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Hotel Rwanda, and this is the second attempt at this. So if it sounds a little canned or forced, it's because we are sort of repeating ourselves, or maybe we're not really sure. We rarely know what we're going to say, so I don't even know what I said yesterday. So it might be fresh. I don't know. We'll see. But our guest is super fresh. He is Jared Wall of Breaking Liberty and Anarcho-Land, and he has written an article recently regarding Rwanda called The Lie of Rwanda, and it is available at the Libertarian Institute. We'll have a link for that on our show notes page at lastnighters.com/142. And with that, we will introduce Jared. Welcome back to the show. We do appreciate you always as a guest. You are here for Breaking Bad, El Camino movie, Gold, and also Captain Phillips talking about Somali pirates. So welcome back.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me. Always fun to talk to you guys.
Oh, it is a lot of fun, especially when we do amateur hour and just have the internet crap out on us and have to re-record everything. It's a lot of fun. But if you could just remind people where they can find your work and maybe talk a little bit about the article just for a moment before we get into the Google description and start talking about the movie.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Breaking Liberty. That was, that seems like a long time ago now that I put together kind of my subtitle is Libertarian Commentary on AMC's Hit Show. I was a big fan of Breaking Bad and ended up, when I was rewatching it with my wife, her for the first time, me for probably the third or fourth time, I just took out a notepad and was starting to jot things down of all the libertarian themes that could be pulled out of it, or the statist themes that a libertarian could complain about out of Breaking Bad, and ended up putting together a whole pretty lengthy couple of ebooks. So if those are available for free to download at breakingliberty.com. For a while I had, as you mentioned, Anarcho-Land. I still own anarcho-land.com, and I had a pretty decent sized Facebook page for a while, but I stopped doing that. I changed my focus to some other things. I do hope to get that back up and running at some point, but I've just focused my time elsewhere outside of work. But yeah, I just recently published a pretty lengthy article, essay, whatever you want to call it, as you said, titled The Lie of Rwanda. I had Scott Horton was nice enough to publish it at his thelibertarianinstitute.org, or I think it's just libertarianinstitute.org. But I don't know, I found it at least twice, you know, in Libya back in 2010 and back in Kosovo back in the 90s, in the mid-late 90s. Rwanda was invoked as reason for why we have to go and militarily intervene, because there's these quote-unquote impending genocides, and you know, we can't just sit around waiting and let another Rwanda happen like we did back in the early 90s with the so-called Rwanda genocide. And I ended up kind of going down a rabbit hole of reading books about, you know, the history of what preceded that and what actually happened during it and after those events in 1994. And basically put together everything I learned in that article, The Lie of Rwanda. And I'm pretty proud of how it came out. It actually ended up getting picked up by Zero Hedge and has been viewed 25,000 plus times. So it's gotten some play, and like I said, I'm pretty proud of that. So I think we'll probably get into some of that history as we go through and talk about the movie here. I guess my big take on the movie is going to kind of repeatedly be that it's really just a piece of propaganda that perpetuates the idea that it was just a very random Hutu genocide against the Tutsis, and that the West sat back and did nothing when, you know, there's a lot more nuance to that that people should understand to have a better, less cartoonish understanding of what happened back then.
All right, very good. Well, we'll definitely have a link to that article on our site at lastnarratives.com/142. It is a pretty lengthy read. I think you said it was over 4,000 words, so it's it does take a little bit of time, but it goes through a lot of the history of not only Rwanda, but also the neighboring countries and the colonial periods, and how Germany and Belgium and France all influenced things in that area. So I think it's pretty interesting stuff. It's a lot of backstory, and it probably changes how people would view this movie, which we will get to right now with the old Google description, how we start this thing off. So here we go. Hotel Rwanda. It was PG-13, came out in 2004. It's called a war/drama film, 2 hours and 2 minutes. It got an 8.1 IMDb, 91% Rotten Tomatoes, and 79% on Metacritic, and 93% of Google users liked it. The description is: Paul Rusesabagina, played by John Cheadle, is a Hutu who manages the Hotel des Mille Collines, which means 1,000 hills, and lives a happy life with his Tutsi wife and their 3 children. But when Hutu military forces initiate a campaign of ethnic cleansing against the Tutsi minority, Paul is compelled to allow refugees to take shelter in his hotel. As the UN pulls out, Paul must struggle alone to protect the Tutsi refugees in the face of the escalating violence later known as the Rwandan genocide. The release date was December 22nd, 2004, and the director is Terry George. And Don Cheadle has a pretty strong performance in this. He got nominated for an Academy Award, did not win, but I think he made a name for himself in this particular movie. And we will go to Robert for your opening information, sir.
Well, okay. All right, then. So, like Jared was saying, this is it's a narrative told from one person's perspective. It's not a documentary giving us the full context and the scope, the history of the conflict. It's very much an insular slice of a bigger story. So, like you've said in the past, this is factual because this is what happened according to him, but not necessarily truthful in the sense you're getting the whole story as to why this is actually happening and actually what else is going on, right? It's just from his perspective, it's these Hutus that are going crazy, killing all these Tutsis because they're upset about some things that have happened in the past. And it's not necessarily predicated due to this invasion of this rebel Tutsi army from the other nearby country. But the movie itself is very much a local businessman tries to curry favor with powerful people to protect a vulnerable population. So it's very much Schindler's List set in Africa, where Paul tries to, you know, get all kinds of like valuable goods that people just can't get. Like it starts off with him like having these Cuban cigars and handing them out to his friends because, you know, money doesn't, at a certain point, you know, it's like marginal utility, right? You get so much money, and a little bit more money is really not that much. But if you can get a cigar that you just can't get otherwise, you're like, oh, so good, so classy, so much style. And so Paul is like currying all these favor with all these people. And in the extent that, or for the purpose of being able to call in his chips when he's in trouble. And the movie is essentially him calling in favors throughout the thing, getting people to protect this hotel from marauding Hutus, marauding soldiers from whatever faction, just wanting to go in there and kill whoever he's trying to protect. Now, I think currying favor and making yourself important to people is excellent strategy. It's a great survival strategy, making yourself important, too important to kill, right? Like, you're worth more to me alive than you are dead. But at some point, shit hits the fan so hard that, like, nothing you could do is going to be worth it to me to protect you from all these hordes of people that want to kill you. So at that point, I think it's important to have your own defense force, some guns, some weapons on the bill. I mean, maybe that would be, I mean, it would just be at least another deterrent. Like at one point there's like four UN guys in blue helmets with that aren't even allowed to fire. And I understand like people are loath to shoot a UN guy because that would bring further reprisals. And you may be more likely to shoot, you know, some African guy, but I mean, you could dress him up as a UN guy. I mean, you could do all kinds of things to actually, you know, be a deterrent to protect your own place, because this movie is entirely about all the lengths he goes to protect the people when I think he's ignoring some pretty obvious ones from my perspective.
Oh, that's interesting. Now I want to know more. So what are the obvious ones real quick?
The obvious ones, actually having weapons. Actually, if anybody comes and rolls up, they know they're going to get shot at. You could use create choke points. You could have sandbags. You could actually take some guns off some dead soldiers, probably right outside your house, right outside the hotel. And if anybody comes rolling up in this Jeep, the actual approach to the hotel in the movie, I don't know about the real one, but in the movie, it's like this winding path. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's them not wanting to drive on the grass. I'm sure they would just drive on the grass. But you could, I mean, using burnt up vehicles, they got these vans, you got trees all over the place. You could actually defend that property in any number of ways other than just relying on the hope that nobody comes and kills you. There are strategic ways to set up your defenses that anybody would go, maybe I'll try the other place because this place looks like a porcupine and I'm not going to go into this porcupine.
Right, right. Yeah, it's just like we said in the pre-show, Jared, you got to just be faster than the other guy getting chased by the bear. So just be like that much more of a deterrent so it looks easier to go somewhere else. Now, I think the strategy that Paul was trying to employ, at least initially, was to have the appearance of still being an operating hotel. And for whatever reason, that would mean that they'd be left alone for some reason. Perhaps because maybe the thinking was, well, there's people from other countries here, European clientele. And so if they were to attack the hotel, that would spark more of an international response versus just domestically, you know, within Rwanda, killing other Rwandans. So maybe that was what kind of the thinking was there.
Right. And that's a good strategy, right? Like I said, that's a good strategy at the beginning and it worked for the most part, but it doesn't work up to that point at which the shit fully hits the fan. And then no matter amount of diplomatic protection is going to do anything. And you actually have to have a gun in your hand to protect those people that you care about.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get Jared's take on the Google description and maybe a little bit of the backstory, at least how it's presented in the film. It's sort of shown to us that the Tutsis had been in charge for a long time, but they were the minority of the population. They got driven out by the Hutus, and then some Tutsis were invading back in, trying to take control of the government. And so that was what brought the Hutus into this situation of wanting to kill all the Tutsis. But we're not really given much more than that in the film.
Yeah, and even that is kind of being generous to what the film shows. I don't think it really got into those kind of details very well or very much at all. There was pieces of it, like they do reference invaders, and there is a little bit of dialogue when Joaquin Phoenix, I know it's Joaquin, but I prefer to say Joaquin. I think it's funnier. When Joaquin Phoenix was hitting on those girls in the bar, there's a little bit of dialogue about like the history, you know, of what's caused the animosity between the Hutus and the Tutsis. With just for the Google description, my biggest problem with that is that it references, I forget exact the verbiage, but it said something along the lines of the violence initiated by the Hutu government and the Hutu militias. And that's just a very false statement. The whole violence was initiated. The aggression started when, as you mentioned, Daniel, the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, invaded from Uganda. And that Rwandan Patriotic Front was kind of a faction of the Ugandan army. And it was made up by a whole bunch of former, or the offspring of the former Tutsi elite that used to rule Rwanda up until like 1958. So, I mean, I guess to maybe get a bit of that backstory, you know, there were animosities between, it's hard to say that there were animosities between all Tutsis and all Hutus. Like, that's just too much of a generalization. That's like saying all Sunnis hate all Shias. That's just not true. Like, they're just like in Iraq, Sunnis and Shias were friends and neighbors and intermarried and whatnot. The same thing is very true in Rwanda. So it was really more so animosity between elites of the two groups. You know, getting back to kind of the history there is that for a long time, for probably hundreds of years prior to imperialism, that part of Africa, which is really like Central Africa, right to the east of Congo, to the west of Lake Victoria, there were the two groups, generally speaking, and the Tutsis were kind of, it was almost like a feudal system, whereas the Tutsis were overlords and the Hutus were serfs. And then in 1885, with the Scramble for Africa and the Berlin Conference and all the fake boundaries and borders getting drawn, Germany came in and took control of what's now become known as Rwanda. I don't know the history of how that name came to be. It probably existed a long time before there. But as far as the borders of Rwanda today, Germany came in 1885 and became the imperial power. And they ruled using Tutsi kings or Tutsi feudal overlords as their proxy rulers. And that continued when the imperialism changed hands from Germany to Belgium after World War I, and Germany lost all of their colonies. Belgium took over and they continued the same thing, where they were just empowering and ruling through Tutsi elite ruling forces and feudal overlords. So they were using them as proxies.
So it's sort of like they already had an existing structure in place, and so it's just easier to utilize that sort of like as their puppet?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a really common strategy for imperialism. Like, if you study the British Empire, you know, that's what they did in India and you know, Persia, etc. So they would pick kind of a minority group that had power and just empower them further and kind of rule through those groups.
Yeah, I can see how that could develop some more animosity, especially if you have groups within a country that are sort of distinct in some way. And in the movie, it's sort of presented like almost this eugenicist phrenology kind of differentiation, like how Jack Daglish, the Joker, Joaquin Phoenix, kind of talks about it is like, well, they just sort of picked certain traits and they called that Tutsi, and other traits they called it Hutu. And it's really, you can't really tell the difference. Like when he picks up on the girls at the bar, he's like, they could be sisters, and one's Hutu and one's Tutsi. Now, I had this joke, like, well, are you saying they all look the same? Because to me, those two girls look very different from each other. But yeah, back to the point, it sounded like it was just sort of this pseudoscience of the day when the Belgians were in control, at least per the movie, where they were determining who was Hutu and who was Tutsi. And because those divisions got drawn, then it became tribal. Then it became, I'm Hutu, I'm Tutsi. And you know, your team sucks, my team's good, that kind of a thing. Where, you know, it's like if you divide like in psychological experiment, I think it was the Stanford prison experiment, you know, half the people based on like eye color or some other random selection were guards and the other half were prisoners. And just putting them on those two teams developed different behaviors and different camaraderie among within groups, and then antagonism between the groups. And I think that almost any time you divide up people into different sections, you're going to get that kind of phenomena.
Another thing, though, that I have a question about, thing that seems to divide and unite people and that sort of thing, is language. And it seems like there's the original African language of something, something Rwanda. I don't know what the name, I have no idea.
Kinyarwanda.
There you go. And I assume that's spoken generally in the region by most Rwandans. But then they were originally colonized by the Germans and then later on the Belgians, but they're a mainly French-speaking nation, and then Paul speaks English. So, and most, well, I'm sure for the movie, probably they speak English, but maybe he was speaking French to the hotel owners. I don't know. But I just, do you happen to know any of the back history on that? Because I know all of Africa was colonized by all the European powers, and I don't know. It's all a big clusterfuck.
That's a good question. I don't really know the answer to it. I mean, they use the francs too, you know, French francs. So I don't really know how France got involved and when and how they ended up being kind of a primarily French-speaking nation. That's a really good question. Maybe you know, need to do some more research on that. But I mean,
is it a network effect where the majority of French people around them spoke French, and so that it behooved them to speak French also? Or
it's possible. And you know what? I'm not even that really good on what language. Like is Belgian a language, or do they speak French in Belgium?
We should
know that, right? I don't think Belgian is a language. I'm going to sound stupid if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure they speak French in Belgium, and that might be a part of it.
Okay.
Anyways, but yeah, and I also, Daniel, to your point, I don't really know, you know, kind of the tribal history there. There probably were different groups known as Tutsis and Hutus, but then, you know, when the Germans and the Belgians came in, they were, you know, just observing, they were like, oh, the Tutsis are taller, the Tutsis have skinnier noses. And that's how, you know, they kind of even perpetuated those kind of, I guess, more or less stereotypes. And
this is during the eugenic time, right? When there's a lot of this phrenology, yes, and eugenics is really exactly kind of popular in the science. And
the late 1800s, early 1900s. Yeah,
figuring out who was
thing.
Good.
They were following the science of the day.
Indeed, they were.
Listening to the scientists.
These are the desirable traits versus the undesirable traits.
Yeah, yeah. So I think one of the key lines that they say is the code phrase that they say on the radio, the propaganda radio, that's like ginning up all these people's animosity and directing it towards specific targets. Their phrase was cut the tall trees. And I wonder if that was sort of meaning like these are the people who have been a higher status than us, and now we're going to bring them down a notch, bring them down a peg. Because it kind of feels like that's sort of what's happening in real time in present day United States, where the prevailing like culture seems to be being torn down in favor of peaceful protests and peaceful fires and peaceful riots and like targeting of what used to be like, you know, the nuclear family and the common culture, Western values and civilization is kind of being torn apart right now. I don't know if I'm saying anything that's like too crazy, but it just kind of, I see some similarities between what we witness in this movie to present day, and it makes me a little nervous.
Well, it's definitely a revolutionary event, right? At least it is depicted in the film, whether or not, I mean, actual history would just say otherwise, but in the film, it definitely seems like a revolutionary. They are just intent on destroying, tearing down what exists and not necessarily working on building up something great. So yeah, I would concur with your assessment there in terms of what seems to be happening with the modern far leftists and their riots and agitations. Yeah, they seem to just be, they're not actually talking about replacing what they're tearing down with anything good. It doesn't seem, just get rid of this bad stuff that we don't like.
It certainly was revolutionary in the term, in the sense that, you know, the Habyarimana's Hutu government was overthrown and a Tutsi government came to power led by Paul Kagame. But that being said, when you think of a revolution, you kind of think of, you know, I guess at least here in America, it was like an internal uprising where, you know, there were a growing force inside of the country that overthrew their government and installed something else. Where in this case, it was, you know, like I said earlier, it was an invasion from outside. It was an invasion from a segment of the Ugandan army. So in that sense, it was more of a like it was an invasion. It was an invasion that was an aggressive war against a democratically elected government.
Now, in the film, the Tutsi rebels—that's the group you're talking about, right? That's how they're referred to. The rebels Now they do show up in the film, and they talk about how they're moving into the city and they're moving through, and then they think that it's going to be peaceful after they take over and the Hutus have to retreat, and then they're seen as like the good guys. But in terms of what you've written, it sounds like they are not the good guys. But you can't really necessarily say the Hutus are good guys either, especially not, I mean, what they were doing. I mean, they just turned on their neighbors. They weren't actually just fighting this invading force. They were like, oh, shit's going down. It's time to get our kill on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a war. So there's no real good guys and bad guys. There's atrocities committed by both sides against both sides and against a lot of innocent people who had nothing to do with it. That being said, you know, when the RPF invaded from Uganda, all of the Hutus obviously fled away because they were like, oh crap, there's this Tutsi army marching south from Uganda. We're in trouble. We got to get away from here. But also all of the, I guess not all, a lot of the Tutsis who were still living in Rwanda who had nothing to do with the RPF also fled away from the RPF because they were like, oh crap, this isn't good. You know, this is going to basically just once again set off all of these tensions between Hutus and Tutsis. And, you know, they were afraid of reprisal killings from, you know, with the history that had been, you know, had gone back a long ways in Rwanda, you know, with Hutus being basically serfs to Tutsi overlords, there probably was a certain level of fear of returning to that kind of situation. And I mean, interestingly, when Habyarimana came to power, I said democratically elected, but it was actually, he led a coup against a government back in 72, I think. But from 72 to 1990, when the RPF invaded, it was a time of relative peace. You know, people were happy. You know, there wasn't all of this sectarian killing going on like we saw in the movie, or in, like what happened for 4 years between 1990 and the so-called genocide in April to July of 1994. Kind of lost my train of thought there, but I mean, it was definitely, there were definitely atrocities committed by both sides, but one side started it, you know, to kind of make a closing
okay.
point there.
Well, it definitely seems like this is a kind of a history written by the winners situation. I mean, you've got the Tutsi army that invades and actually capture the capital, right? And then they're still in power to this day. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. The RPF, because I mean, another interesting point is that the genocide ended in July of 1994 when the, you know, it was a genocide against the Tutsis. The genocide, so-called genocide, ended in July of 1994 when the Tutsi army won the war. You know, so it doesn't really ring true that the genocide against the Tutsis ended when the Tutsis won the war. It kind of goes against the whole narrative that it was just a straight up genocide. It's more complicated than that. But yes, the RPF, they shot down Habyarimana's plane in April of 1994, which was really the triggering point, and it's referenced in the movie, you know, that they shot down the plane. And that was really the triggering point of the Hutu militias and, you know, what was left of Habyarimana's Hutu military and army just going crazy and starting to just slaughter Tutsis, regardless of whether they were a part of the RPF or not. But, you know, the RPF overthrew, or they killed Habyarimana, and then in July of 1994 they overthrew what was left of that Hutu government, and then Kagame, who was the leader of the RPF, has been in power ever since then and to this day.
And this narrative that this is just a big Hutu massacre is something that the West, or at least the United States, really appreciates, because a lot of the RPF was trained and funded by the United States. Is that correct?
Well, yes, a lot of the Ugandan army was very heavily trained and funded by the U.S. You know, since Museveni is a dictator of Uganda, he's been in power since 86. And in the, even just in the years between 86 and 1990, when the RPF invaded, the U.S. gave him hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in aid and military aid and weapons and training. And the when the RPF invaded, Paul Kagame, who, like I said, he was one of the main generals of the RPF, he was, at the time of the invasion, he was in the U.S. at Fort Leavenworth studying psyops and propaganda and things like that. And then very early on, after the RPF invaded, you know, the U.N. Placed an embargo on arms shipments into Rwanda. And that embargo was enforced extremely strictly in the case of Habyarimana's government, but it was ignored almost entirely in terms of the RPF invaders. Like, throughout the entire war from 1990 until 1994, Uganda was routinely shipping money, arms, ammunition, supplies, men into Uganda to join the RPF and continue that fight.
Mm. So maybe that's why in the movie, like, the Hutus are receiving shipments of machetes, because they can't get other, you know, like, firearms.
They got them from, like, China, right? Like, some machetes from China for, like, 10 cents or something.
Yeah, super cheap. Good price. And in our first attempt at recording yesterday, Jared, I think you were saying that when the RPF started to invade and the Tutsis who were still living in Rwanda, the Hutus were worried about potential sleeper cells from the people who were still living in Rwanda and were Tutsi. And so they were probably of the thought that we don't know who we can trust, who is potentially a subversive, who, you know, yeah, they're our neighbor, but they're a Tutsi and they might be a sleeper cell. So that might have been a motivating factor for when, in times of war, they felt it was a thing they needed to do to kill all the Tutsis. And, you know, I'm by no means condoning it, but I can kind of, like, start to see some of the thought process that might lend itself to that, especially when they're being ginned up and propagandized. They're sort of like useful idiots that are being kind of funneled into certain actions that are desirable by the elites pulling the strings.
Right. And dehumanizing their enemy. Like, these cockroaches need to die. And you're talking about, like, old men, old women, children, and they're just going to hack them all to pieces.
Yeah, I mean, the RPF bragged about having sleeper cells inside of Rwanda at the time of the invasion, and even, you know, in the days leading up to the invasion. And so, yeah, I mean, it definitely makes sense that there would be a certain fear and distrust of anybody who's a Tutsi, because, you know, the invading force, who is led by elite Tutsis, are saying, hey, we've got these partners that are ready to join us in the fight once we cross the border and once we start fighting. And you know, an important point to make is that when the RPF invaded, it wasn't like they just straight up went after Habyarimana's Hutu military and Hutu army. They just were, there was a scorched earth campaign. You know, so they were committing all kinds of atrocities from 1990 through the end of the war and killing a whole bunch of innocent people. And even in the so-called genocide time period from April to July of 94, there's some estimates that more Hutus were killed during those months than Tutsis. So again, you know, the simple narrative that this was a Hutu against Tutsi genocide just doesn't really, it's hard for that to hold water.
Yeah, I think maybe it was listed in your article or something else I was reading in preparation for this, but there was some argument that there was almost a double genocide from both sides that was at play here. So there's really a lot more going on. And as part of the movie was shot in Kigali, is that how you say the name of the city?
I think so. Kigali, I think.
Yeah. I would think that they would have had to have permission to be there from the Tutsi-led government. And so the story might have been, you know, sort of massaged into what we see here by a guy who's led Rwanda since he invaded in the 90s, Kagame, who was trained in psychological psyops, you know, propaganda. So you'd see a movie like this come out. Of course, his side's going to be the heroes, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I mean, I think it also leads into, you know, an interesting kind of commentary. I mean, I think you're definitely right that in order for him to sign off on it being filmed or having, you know, film crews come in and make this movie, it had to be somewhat, you know, geared towards being sympathetic to his side. But it's interesting because, you know, like I said, the RPF was a breakoff of the Uganda military. So Kagame, you know, even before, you know, from 86 through 90, Kagame was very high up in Museveni's National Resistance Army, which is the Ugandan army. he was actually the chief of intelligence to Museveni. So he was really tight with Museveni at the time. Since then, though, especially like in the late 90s and early 2000s, Kagame and Museveni have become like enemies, you know, even though they worked together on overthrowing the Habyarimana government. As they, you know, as Kagame, I guess, got more and more power, being the leader of a whole nation as opposed to just, you know, a general and an invading army, there's been some serious tensions between Rwanda and Uganda. And similarly, this Paul Rusesabagina, I think I'm saying that right, he's now been, ever since 1994, you know, as it kind of shows at the end of the movie, him and the people that he saved left the country. He's been outside of the country ever since then and has been a very vocal critic of Kagame's government, even warning of a new genocide happening that was going to be Tutsi-led against the Hutus. And just recently, like a couple of weeks ago, he was extradited from, I think it was Dubai, it might have been the UAE, but he was extradited from there back to Rwanda, and now he is facing all kinds of criminal charges, including terrorism and you know, subversion, or I don't know the whole list of charges, but it's something like 13 charges, and he was detained without access to a lawyer for a few days and without having even his charges brought against him, without being able to see his family. So he was almost kind of black bagged for a while. But that's an ongoing and developing story, but it kind of just goes to speak to the nature of the Kagame government today.
So do we have any idea what the demographics of Rwanda are currently? Is it majority Tutsi now, or is it still the same kind of thing that was before, majority Hutu but minority led Tutsi?
I mean, I think it's still got to be majority Hutu. I don't know exactly the demographics today, but throughout the history of that area, it's always been 80-90% Hutu and 10-20% Tutsi, and that's not going to change too drastically. You know,
and they're not having like elections or anything, are they?
No, they are, but Kagame is getting like 90%, 95%. But
they have elections.
Yeah, they're contested or not necessarily like totally believable.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think in some cases they even have elections where there's one name on the ballot, you know. So I'm not 100% sure of that, but I know that that happened in Yemen back in like 2000, is that there was a one name election, and they called it, I think Hillary Clinton decried it as like the triumph of democracy when that happened in Yemen. And I'm pretty sure similar stuff.
Like you can select from this Tutsi guy or that Tutsi guy. It's like, there's your,
you can select from Paul Kagame or Paul Kagame.
By the way, everyone, we got one of our listeners has said that French is one of the three official languages of Belgium alongside Dutch and German. So thank you, Facebook user. You didn't do the permissions to show the name, but thank you for the correction for us so we can actually learn something on this show. So that's what we do here. We learn stuff. Also,
it sounds like he was saying that we were right.
But now we know.
Yeah. Well, another, yeah, thank you, Facebook user.
Another trivia note, I guess the word Rwanda, it means Thousand Hills. So the Hotel Milis Collines is Belgian for Thousand Hills, but Rwanda is Thousand Hills for whatever the name origin was. So I guess French. Is it French? Or is Rwanda
I thought we just determined that there is no such thing as the Belgian language.
Oh, right. Yeah, French. Yeah, sorry. but the word Rwanda, I think, is more related to the Rwandan language that you were talking about earlier, that would mean, yeah, a Thousand Hills as well. And so that would ties the name of the hotel together with the name of the country. Gotcha. All right. There we go. See, convoluted. I feel like I'm Biden up here, reading off a teleprompter, playing some music for everyone. Did you guys see that? He's like playing some, I don't even know, like Mexican music. He's trying to like pander to get the vote. And Trump actually tweeted a re-edited version of Biden up there holding the phone, playing it with NWA's Fuck the Police. It's hilarious. I'll have to send that to you guys.
Okay. I'll have to check that out.
Please do. I always like to laugh at Joe Biden, so I would appreciate you sending that over.
Well, make it disabled, unbelievable.
You might get 4 years of laughing at him. We'll see. We'll see if he can last.
We can only hope.
Well, one other thing I wanted to bring up, sort of related to the movie, and I don't know if this played out per se in real life or not, but I've seen this kind of thing happen in other movies depicting these dystopian kind of futures or dystopian situations where neighbor turns on neighbor. And so you can basically just, if there's somebody you don't like for whatever reason, you just say, oh yeah, I heard they're a spy. Or yeah, I heard they're a Tutsi. I mean, you kind of see it even today in the pandemic, you know, or like swatting. Yeah. It's like a
tactic. He's a racist. That guy's a racist over there. Let's beat his ass.
Right.
That's an obvious, easy mob tactic.
Yeah, or he's a Trump supporter or whatever. And it's something that you see like in East German Stasi. And, you know, they talk about it in this with Victor the Gardener. And Paul, you know, when they see that their neighbor's getting taken away, they don't feel like there's anything they can do. And I kind of feel like, yeah, I mean, what would you do? You know, there's armed military like taking your neighbor away. What are you going to do?
Right. And Paul wanted to, his wife wanted him to call in some favors to protect his neighbor. But he was like, no, we got to save those for ours. We don't have us. We don't have an unlimited supply of favors we can draw on, which is true. He didn't.
Right. Yeah. And it seemed like that was like the modus of operandi. Yeah. Of like a socialist type country, which I imagine Rwanda kind of was, to where you're doing these things to kind of curry favor, to get kind of like unofficial favors, to get things done, to kind of grease palms and to get around some of the bureaucracy that might otherwise be in your way. So I think that was one of the kind of things that played a role in this. And when he's talking about getting those Cuban cigars, it might have been a joke, but he said, you know, say hi to Fidel for me. So it makes me think that maybe they had sympathetic leanings towards Cuba and socialist nations.
Possibly, absolutely. I did want to talk a little bit about the movie in terms of like the scenes. There's a few scenes that are kind of a little bit interesting. There was one where, like you were saying, that the marauding like Hutu militia was kind of like running around and blackbagging these Tutsis. And at one point they come in to Paul's house and he's like, you're coming in with me. We're going to go open up this safe at this hotel. And he's like, you know, okay, I got to bring my family with me. And then they get to the hotel. He opens it up. He comes back out and he's like, you lied to me, Paul. These are all cockroaches. And so then Paul then has to negotiate with this terrorist to not murder his friends and family. And he ends up basically bribing the guy not to murder them. And it just struck me how weak his position was. I mean, sure, he was outnumbered. He was outgunned heavily. Of course, he didn't have a weapon himself. But here he was negotiating with this guy who was going to murder all these people who saw them as less than human or absolutely just the enemy, even though they're just like helpless women and children and old people. And here Paul is bargaining for their lives and he's like giving them all this money and whatever on the spot. But what's to stop the guy? I mean, you're kind of trusting the honor of this terrorist to uphold the bargain, right? And to not just be like, murder them the next day, or have you bribed him, fine, but you didn't bribe that other guy over there and that other guy over there. Who's to say those guys aren't just going to open up his machine gun on him? It just seemed like a really weak position. He got away with it, but I just hated seeing him in that vulnerable position. And I think he could have learned something from that at some point and that was in the beginning of the movie. And then he just kept that same tactic the whole movie. And I really wanted him to grow as a character and realize that he had to do something physical to actually protect those people that he cared about, but he didn't.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. But I don't know what he really could have done. It didn't seem like he was a guy who was like super into, you know, having a bunch of skills, nunchuck skills and bo staff skills to be able to protect himself or his family. And I don't know what the position of having arms themselves was, or even if they were available, but he did say that he wasn't a guy who was a fan of guns. Cause when that guy said, you have to kill one of these cockroaches, you know, he declined, saying that he wasn't a fan of using guns. So it probably wasn't in his nature. Also, Paul seemed to be fairly naive, especially early on in the film. Like when his brother and sister-in-law come and they're like, hey, we're hearing these things. We want to get out of here. And he's like, no, I'm sure everything will be fine. Just wait till tomorrow. We'll talk tomorrow. And of course, that night, you know, they end up getting taken, and then his two nieces end up missing for a long, long time. But it kept feeling like Paul didn't take the situation seriously enough, early enough, for my liking.
Right, and that's why I'm okay with him bargaining that first time, like in the beginning of the film. From a narrative standpoint, you got a growth opportunity for that character. And I know they wanted to tell kind of a historical story and what actually kind of happened from this guy's perspective. But if you want to make a compelling narrative, you have him learn the lesson of being in that weak position in the beginning and then work towards not being in that weak position later on. It just seemed like a natural growth opportunity for the character that didn't happen in the film. And that's kind of
missed opportunity. I think he did try a few other tactics, especially after the UN was pulling out. He went for the emotional heartstrings of having everyone who was a refugee there contact anyone they knew internationally and have that conversation like, this is the last time you're going to talk to me because I'm going to die, you know, to try to get some action. And then when he talked to the CEO of Sabena, he got him to contact the Prime Minister of France to somehow prevent some other attack on the hotel from happening. Like he kept pulling strings further and further up the chain as best as he could. So he was escalating at least like the path that he was using to try to get further protection.
I agree, but he was also established as a person that could get things. And if you're telling me that in the middle of a war, you can't get yourself a crate of AK-47s, I don't know what to do, man. I just don't know. And you wouldn't even have to have people skilled or trained in how to shoot them. You stick an AK-47 in each room facing the road, and you just say, hey, someone stick your AK out when we blow a whistle. And then all of a sudden there's like 50 or 100 guns pointing at you when you're just coming up to roll up on the place. You're going to turn around and run away real fast.
They would look pretty badass.
Yeah, it'd be a porcupine. You'd be like, no gracias. I'm going to go at the other place that isn't loaded for bear. I don't know. It just seemed like an obvious thing to me that didn't happen. And I was kind of questioning why.
Yeah. Now, one other thing I wanted to ask, and then we're going to have to start winding down. Somehow we've almost used an hour already. But another thing that Paul did was he came to an agreement with his wife to where if the hotel were attacked and the militia were there, he told his wife to jump off the top of the building with the kids. And there's a moment in the film where you don't know what's happened because they're there and Paul has just gotten back. And, you know, it's a harrowing, frightening experience. And this movie does pull on some emotional levers here, but there's a period of time where you think she might've done it. And of course, you know, spoilers, it's revealed that she hasn't done it, but if she had followed along with what they agreed to do, then she would have done it. And I think that he would have learned from that experience to not have such a plan in place. Though I kind of understand why you would do it, because getting hacked to death with a machete over the course of hours would be a far worse way to go than a more sudden situation. You know, like seeing your wife or kids hacked up or, you know, worse, violated in other ways, I think I'd rather, you know, be the quick kind of less suffering kind of way of going.
Sure. I'd agree. And I also question what her plan was when she had the whole family hide in the bathtub as if they wouldn't look behind the curtain. I just, okay.
Oldest trick in the book.
I mean, I get you. There aren't a whole lot of places, but there's got to be crawl spaces. There's got to be an attic. I don't know. There's got to be something.
That was a nice little piece of comic relief there too, when she was pointing the shower sprayer thing outwards as if she was going to shoot somebody with the shower.
If he had been armed, that's a good way to get yourself shot first, which I guess is maybe the best way to go. I don't know.
And Paul says to her, what were you going to do with this? That was really funny.
Yeah. Indeed.
And in the midst of a whole bunch of non-funny stuff, that was a little piece of humor.
Yeah, but the movie does have a good heart. I would agree with that. It's all based on family and a man trying to protect his family. So I think there's going to be plenty of room for people to empathize with the character. So I can see why this movie was as well received as it was. And the history, the actual history of the conflict is completely unknown, I would think, in the West. So I think this movie is going to play really well here. So I could see how well that would do.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent that the West people here know anything about the conflict. It's you know, it's the phrase I used earlier. It's kind of a cartoon version that, you know, there was a genocide and we sat around on our hands and did nothing, even though we knew it was going to happen and we could have done something, but we didn't. And now, you know, from now on, anytime there's an impending genocide, we have to, you know, send in the Marines and send in the predator drones and stop it. And that's become, it's become a propaganda narrative to allow, you know, Barack Obama to invade Libya or to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya, to allow Bill Clinton to invade and overthrow or to cause all the chaos in Kosovo and Bosnia back in the 90s. You know, this false narrative as to what happened in Rwanda has led to a lot of, it's been really good for the military industrial complex. And so, I mean, that's why, you know, I appreciate you guys having me on to talk about the movie. I definitely would encourage people to go and read my article about it and get a little bit more of a longer kind of revisionist history, or more expansive history as to what actually happened, what actually led up to this and what has happened since then. And also what might have been some of the motivating factors to the West siding with the, you know, the Tutsi invaders, the RPF invaders, and why they were so, why they've been so friendly to Museveni, you know, the Ugandan dictator, why they've given him so much money in arms and weapons. And, you know, not to spoil the surprise, it's because there's a whole bunch of very valuable resources in that part of Africa. There's trillions of dollars worth of gold and platinum and coltan and just all kinds of stuff that, you know, Congo, I just looked it up recently, the Congo, which neighbors to the west, both Uganda and Rwanda, is the poorest country in the world per capita, but they have probably the most natural resources in the whole world. So theoretically, it should be the richest country in the world, but it's the poorest. And it's because there's all these external powers fighting for control of those resources, or at least in large part, that's a big reason. You know, they don't have a very good government themselves, but, you know, even that is a lot of the fault of outside influences.
Yeah, lots of interesting stuff. And your article is up at libertarianinstitute.org, and we'll have a link to that on our show notes page, lastnarratives.com/142. And we're probably at the point where we got to get into some final summary and review. So, Robert, if you wouldn't mind kicking us off and give us a rating.
Sure. Well, this is the movie that seemingly launched Don Cheadle's career. This is the first thing I ever saw him in. I'm sure he did some smaller stuff before this, but he has since gone on to become quite the movie star. And it's no wonder why. He's quite good in this. His role allows for all kinds of different emotions and different ways to play the character. At one point, he breaks down. He runs over all these dead bodies, and he's trying to change his clothes to continue on with his day, and he just can't take it. He's affected. He's a human being, and he's not just this robot that can keep on going in the face of all this horror. So, yeah, like we've said, this movie it's kind of a cartoonish tale of the actual events. It's definitely told from one person's perspective, showing a very narrow view of the conflict. But what it does, you know, and I can't really fault it for that. It's not a documentary in the same way that Schindler's List wasn't a documentary. It was definitely, Schindler's List was also a propaganda piece. Not to say that none of the events happened. I'm sure they absolutely did happen, but it was definitely told from a certain perspective to tell a particular, you know, to generate support for a particular way of looking at the thing. Same with this. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. I don't really know. We didn't really get into Jared's view on whether this movie was ultimately a positive thing or not. It has brought more eyeballs onto the events in Rwanda from the winner's perspective, which is, of course, going to be very skewed. But the movie, it's pretty janky looking, especially in the beginning. There's some pretty bad green screen of them in this van at the beginning. It seems like those were the scenes that were shot probably on a soundstage later on, maybe as some pickup, or they decided that they just needed some more stuff. They couldn't shoot in this place anymore. They had to pick it up later. And it just doesn't look great. At the beginning, you're watching this movie and you're like, is this just like a made-for-TV movie? Doesn't look good. But the acting in the story does hold up. The, like I said, the storyline of just a man trying to protect what he loves against overwhelming odds is strong. Even though I don't think that the character really grows a whole lot, but you know, it's based on real events, and they wanted to be a little more accurate to the character instead of trying to Hollywood it up or trying to storyify it. So I can't really complain too much. I would give it it's hard to give a propaganda movie really high rating, but at the same time, from a propaganda rating, from an accurate, description of the conflict, it's very low. But if as an entertaining film, it's more of like a 7. But it is what it is. It's if you actually go and look at more of what's happening in the world, hopefully you're not just watching this and saying, oh, that's what happened, and then that's it, and then you have no more curiosity. If it inspires you to learn more, then it's a good thing. If it doesn't and it satisfies your curiosity and you think you know all that happened, then maybe it's not so good.
All right. Well, Robert, that's a pretty good take. And I'll just echo that if this does pique your interest, then Jared's article will give you a lot of the nuance and the prehistory to the events in this that precipitate what we see on the screen, and even correct some of the things. As we were discussing earlier, there were atrocities kind of on both sides and a lot of precipitating events, a lot of outside influences, a lot of things were in play. And we just see a very narrow view of it from one man's perspective. And it is a story about family. And I'm just going to kind of dive into my review here and his quest to survive and protect the people that he loves and the people that he's able to protect as best as he can. And there's a whole lot of emotion that's being toyed with here. I felt my eyes water well up a little bit because I thought of like how I would handle that situation with my wife and my kids. I don't know if I could handle it as well as Paul did in real life and as Don Cheadle's portrayal of it was in the movie. But it was a gripping, entertaining piece, and it does bring at least some notoriety to a horrible event that would probably otherwise not be anything other than something that was on the news on CNN or headline news for a couple of weeks at some point 25 years ago. So for that, I think it does bring some much needed recognition to an area and an event that happened. And there's a lot more that you can dig into. And one of those things is Jared's article that we were talking about earlier. But from a technical aspect, yeah, I think that there's some flaws with the movie. It's not like the most well executed. The green screen is pretty bad. Nick Nolte's character, he's very cardboard cutout. It's a bit of a one note thing, but it's still interesting and it's still worth the watch. And so I'm glad I saw it, and I'm glad that we discussed it tonight, especially having a guest like Jared on, who knows a lot about the history of the area and just about Africa in general. So with that, we'll go over to you, Jared, for your final summary and a score. Oh, I need to give a score. I'm going to give it a 7 as well. There we go. 7 for me.
Yeah, I mean, really enjoyed listening to both of your takes there. If it were strictly kind of a work of fiction, I think it's an excellent movie. I think it's very entertaining. It pulls on the heartstrings, and like what you're saying, Daniel, it really, if you can, it shows the horrors of war very, very well, and just how terrible the situation war is and why war should be avoided at and opposed 100% of the time. Aggressive war, that is. It's just for me, it's kind of Robert, what you were saying, that if it were to inspire somebody to go and learn more about what happened in the history of it, I just don't have a very high opinion of the average American viewer of this movie. I don't think many of them will. I think they'll watch it as if it was a documentary, and then it kind of just goes to perpetuate the propaganda that's gone along with the fact, or the so-called fact, that there was a genocide in Rwanda, and the West knew it was happening, yet sat on their hands and did nothing, and therefore we have to intervene in all similar cases moving forward. Like I said, it was just 10 years ago that Samantha Power and Susan Rice in Barack Obama's administration invoked the memory of Rwanda as justification for overthrowing Gaddafi and turning Libya into just a complete chaos state. I mean, slave auctions came back to Libya, like real life, you know, people up on stands and people bidding for them. It came back to Libya because of that intervention and because, in part, this lie that I call it of what happened in Rwanda back in 1994 was cited as reason of why they needed to do it. You know, as far as the movie itself goes, you know, you're right. The green screens were pretty bad in some cases. Don Cheadle's acting was phenomenal. Nick Nolte and Joaquin Phoenix's acting were not phenomenal. One of the things that really, I mean, in addition to them constantly referring to the RPF invaders as rebels and conjuring up the image that this was an internal rebellion against an oppressive government, which is not the case at all. In addition to that, you know, the movie gets the timeline of what happened, even you know, in just that narrow period that the movie was set in. It gets that all wrong. You know, it references peace talks and a peace agreement, and then it references Habyarimana's plane getting shot down, and then everything goes to haywire. Those peace agreements was almost a year prior to all of this happening, and the movie makes it seem like it was, you know, one right after the other. So I took a little bit of issue with that. I also took issue with their portrayal of the UN's involvement. It kind of showed Nick Nolte and the UN as, you know, standing around and doing nothing, when in reality the UN really sided with the RPF invaders. You know, they helped the RPF march south when the UNAMIR, United Nations something mission for something Rwanda, the actual, what that acronym stands for is in my article. I don't remember off the top of my head, but the UNAMIR forces, when they showed up in Rwanda as so-called peacekeeping forces, they went to where the RPF was in northern Rwanda. They hadn't really been able to break past Habyarimana's army, and the UN forces helped them march south and set up base in Kigali, in the capital. And then later on, the UN forces shut down one of the runways. There were two runways in the Kigali airport. They shut down one of them, making it so that any approaching plane could only land from one direction. And, you know, if anybody was wanting to take a shot at a plane, it made it a lot easier. And then that's exactly what happened, is that Habyarimana's plane got shot down. So
coincidence.
I think so. you know, so I didn't really, I look at the movie as really just a piece of propaganda. I think it has helped perpetuate the military industrial complex interests, and I think it has helped perpetuate the empire. So for those reasons, and even though I enjoy watching the movie, just knowing what I know and knowing the truth of what happened and knowing what the movie is kind of being used for, I have to give it a pretty low score. I'll probably give it a 5. I'll give it a black and red.
Wow. Yeah. You know, after hearing you say that, yeah, I don't know. The purpose in which it's being used is pretty nefarious. So yeah, that's, I might give it a demerit.
In terms of just from an entertainment standpoint, I mean, it is a good movie. It's fun to watch. You know, like I said, if it was just a piece of fiction, I would probably give it an 8, you know, a 7.5. But the fact that it's really, you know, what it's being used for, you know, like you articulated, Daniel, I take issue with it. And War and Peace is, you know, of the, you know, I came into the libertarian world through Ron Paul, and his three biggest issues were War and Peace, the Fed, and the war on drugs. And War and Peace was far and away number one. And I've kind of, I think I agree with him 100%. And, you know, being that this movie kind of is being used to perpetuate the, you know, like I said, the empire and the militarism, I got to give it a low score.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that there really is. We're living in a time of so much media. There's just massive amounts of media, and we people are one of the most entertained human. We're probably the most entertained human beings that have ever existed, right? I mean, there's just so much available, and it's really rare when one piece comes along and it really catches your attention and makes you want to deep dive into that topic. Most of the time, the vast majority of the time, people watch the film like this and see it kind of more as a documentary. More as like the definitive, like there's, I mean, how many other movies have been made about this time? So this is all we have to go on. So yeah, I guess I know all I need to know about Rwanda. So
people getting their history from movies and TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Rwanda, just the word Rwanda conjures up all kinds of images in people's heads. You know, I have arguments or discussions with people that I'm close to about, you know, the need to end militarism and the need to end empire. And people are always like, well, what about Rwanda? What about cases where we need to intervene? And, you know, it's movies like this that kind of perpetuate that mindset.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to need to end it here, guys. It was a really good discussion. And if people want to hear some bonus content where we started to talk about this movie for about 45 minutes and had to abandon ship, I think we said a lot of different stuff tonight. So if people want to get even more content that's unique and related to this particular movie, hit us up on our Patreon at lastnighters.com/Patreon, and you can get full access to that hour and 16 minutes of recording. You can also get the pre-show from this night's recording, and we're about to get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is bonus content after the show where we get a little bit looser, you know, hang out just a bit more. Next week, Roberts, we thought we were done. We thought we were out, but they're pulling us back in. Keith Knight is pulling us back in. We're doing more on The Godfather. We had a really good discussion with him on The Godfather trilogy a couple of weeks ago, and we ran out of time. We had so much more to say. And so we cut that short and said that we would come back in a few weeks. So now is the time to do that. And unfortunately, all that stuff I thought I had to say, I wrote some of it down, but now I've forgotten most of it. So I'm going to have to maybe listen to that episode again tonight so that I get some more notes about what to talk about tomorrow with Keith, because that guy could talk a mile a minute, and we love him. And it's going to be a lot of fun having him on again, talking about The Godfather, our part two of The Godfather trilogy, our next episode.
Yeah, Keith the Master, he's a beast. He will be able to, we'll be able to ride his ample hide, his very sturdy libertarian mind all the way. So I don't know, hopefully you'll have some memories jogged when we record that, but it'll be a good episode, I'm sure.
Indeed it will be. So join us next week for Godfather, and if you like what we do here, do give us a subscribe on the old YouTube. You can watch these on YouTube, and if you get the Patreon, you can watch us make them live. You can get pre-show and post-show content, bonus content. You can also give us a rating or review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, wherever podcasts are sold. Ours are of course free for you, but what else can they do, Robert? I think there's some other ways they can support you, especially you specifically, like at Trubster.com. You have some merchandise that you make that people can get their hands on.
Yeah, there is some there at Trubster.com. It's just a redirect right now to TeePublic. But, you know, it's something I really should revisit. There are some good stuff there, but there's so many other opportunities that I could be designing for. I just haven't put my energies into that realm. But if you do want to, that is the place to do it. And yeah, thanks for listening. It's been a great another episode of this podcast. I enjoy it. Thank you all for tuning in.
All right, everyone. And thank you, Jared, for being our guest. And we'll get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. And good night from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we are still on the Actual Anarchy podcast for just a few more minutes. I'm trying to buy some time for Jared to get back in his seat and be able to hear us. But this is episode 199 of the show. Show notes more at actualanarchy.com/199. And I often try to save a question for this portion of the show before we get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive. And we sort of started talking about it a little bit at the end of the Last Nighters portion. And that was, when is it appropriate to intervene? Like, what would be an appropriate response? Like, Jared, you were, your article is on the Libertarian Institute, and that, of course, is run by the great Scott Horton, who is a foreign policy expert talking about the Middle East and war and all of those things. What would you think that Scott's advice would be for someone who becomes aware of a situation like Rwanda happening? What is the appropriate response for a person or to agitate for? I mean, granted, we do live in a, you know, a state-run world, so it's not the perfect libertarian society, where in a libertarian society, I would think if there's some atrocity happening somewhere, people could voluntarily, you know, band together and devote resources and go and try to, you know, prevent those atrocities from happening. But what do you think, like, the Scott Horton or the Ron Paul reply would be to a Rwandan type situation?
Well, I think number one would be, or I don't even really know how to order it, but, you know, the fact that, you know, there was this embargo that, you know, I guess an embargo is a good thing in this kind of a case, you know, don't send weapons into it. But the U.S. was continually sending weapons into Uganda, and then those weapons were making their way across the border into, you know, to their former comrades in the RPF. And, you know, the U.N. basically worked alongside the RPF. So it would be to, you know, stop sending foreign aid, stop sending military aid to these countries, stop bringing their military leaders over to the U.S. to train them, stop providing trainers to, you know, the U.S. has sent a whole bunch of U.S. commando trainers to Rwanda since Kagame came to power. That doesn't really, it's not exactly speaking to your question, but, you know, those kind of things, just stop doing what they are doing would definitely be the, you know, the very first thing that, you know, I think Ron Paul or Scott Horton would advise, is that the people should, the American people should petition their government to stop sending arms to the invaders, to stop sending arms into a war, period. I mean, look what's happening in Syria and all over the Middle East. It's really all those arms and that the U.S. has been dumping into these conflicts is just like pouring gasoline onto a fire, and that was a lot of what happened in Rwanda, and one of the reasons why it was able to get so bloody, and why the RPF was able to successfully invade and overthrow the government.
So, basically, the George Washington foreign policy of don't get into foreign entanglements, right?
Exactly.
Well, yeah, how about not having your own soldiers be immune to war crimes? When did that become a thing that, oh, we're just going to all agree that our soldiers are somehow immune to doing that?
That's interesting you bring that up. I mentioned this in my article, but in the criminal, there was a international criminal tribunal that was arranged by the UN and by the ICC after all of this happened. And in 2003, there happened to be a prosecutor who came in, and who from 1995, when the tribunal was formed, actually it might have been 1994, November of 94, when it was formed, all the way through the late 90s into the early 2000s, the criminal tribunal focused 100% solely on Hutu war crimes. Didn't look into any RPF invasion, didn't look into any Tutsi war crimes at all. And then in 2003, there was a prosecutor who came to be in charge of that tribunal, started calling RPF leaders and people to, started bringing charges against the RPF. And the U.S. came in and took him out, I think it was her, Carla Del Ponte, if I'm getting that name right, took her out and put in somebody who you know, stop doing that. And coincidentally, at the same time, that was when the U.S. was invading Iraq and was looking for nations all around the world to sign agreements that they wouldn't, that U.S. soldiers would not be subject to war crimes. And Rwanda happened to be, you know, led by the RPF, Kagame's RPF. Rwanda was the very first African country to sign one of those agreements with the U.S. right after the U.S. had taken out, had removed this prosecutor who was starting to look at the RPF.
Isn't that just a license to do whatever you want? I mean,
absolutely. What a mockery of justice, doesn't it?
Crime's a crime. A war crime's a war crime, no matter if you say ahead of time, oh, yeah, it's okay. You can commit war crimes, whatever you want.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just insane. And Robert, your point is 100% correct. You know, the idea that soldiers from certain countries, just, you know, because we've agreed to it ahead of time, aren't going to be subject to war crime charges is insane. You know, it's as insane as dumping gasoline on a hornet's nest, you know, as sending arms and soldiers and weapons and bombs into these places where conflicts are already going on.
Yeah, it's a mockery of justice. And I wonder if it's part of this vestigial thing. Like when we were watching Casablanca, Robert, the German general there was like, we're going to follow this by the book. We're going to follow the laws. But they were really kind of meaningless. They were just doing it kind of for show. And I wonder if part of these, you know, war crime like free-for-alls are because war crimes were levied against German officers from World War II. And so there's this sort of like within the psyche or in, you know, historical record, war crimes aren't a thing. And now we're sort of like saying, well, okay, they're a thing, but now we're going to like absolve ourselves from those because we're the good guys.
Right. Yeah. So I assume that if Germany had won World War II, that they would not have prosecuted their own soldiers for war crimes. It's usually the winners prosecuting the losers for war crimes, but it's just a complete mockery of justice where, oh, our soldiers are all noble and pure and never do anything wrong, and your soldiers are all evil and vile and did everything wrong. It's absolutely abhorrent, disgusting behavior.
Yeah,
but if you want to try and convince a bunch of young people to go murder people on other, you know, a bunch of people who've never done anything, you don't want to actually have them suffer consequences other than, of course, getting killed and maimed and whatever, because that doesn't look good back home to the families. It's like, what? My son's in jail somewhere for serving his country? That wouldn't encourage recruitment at all.
I kind of feel like the lack of consequences or shielding people from consequences for their actions is one of the big contributing factors to why we are where we are today as a society.
Sorry, you cut out there. I didn't hear that.
Oh man, I got censored on my own platform.
That's me. I don't know.
That's Kagame's secret police for you.
Yeah. I was saying that I think that the lack of consequences or the shielding people from consequences of their actions is one of the reasons why society is where it's at today.
Absolutely. No, people need to suffer consequences for their actions. If they're acting badly, they need to be punished in one way or another.
You learn from a situation, you know, you learn from failure, you learn from doing the wrong thing and getting reprimanded, you know, those types of things, like having consequences and having like, you know, good things happen when you do good things and bad things happen when you do bad things. That kind of makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. If good things happen when you do bad things, you're going to get a whole lot more bad things. Kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that, you know, an institution like the UN or the International Criminal Court is there to kind of mitigate all of these atrocities that are going on is really just laughable. You know, just the history of it, looking at it is, you know, the US is the big kid on the block and therefore basically funds all of those institutions. The UN is majority funded by the US. The International Criminal Court is vastly majority funded by the US. Therefore, whatever those institutions do and, you know, wherever their leanings are going to be towards the U.S. and U.S. interests.
So it's kind of just for show.
It's 100% for show. And it sounds good. And it makes people think that there's this overarching, you know, justice system, you know, that's going to be that's going to mediate between countries. And it's not the case. It's like if you and I got into a fight and then we went to court, but I was paying the judge's salary and the jury's salary, you know, what do people expect to happen in that kind of a situation?
Yeah, indeed. It's a wonder that anything good in the world happens with the deck stacked against truth and justice and actual good things. It's really bizarre.
Yeah. The market, we just got to hope it keeps outpacing the government. And you know, like Robert, what you said earlier, we're the richest humans who have ever lived in the, you know, in the history of the world. We have more technology available. We have, I find it fascinating. I always think it's a good anecdote that, you know, the leftists and Bernie supporters and whatnot are always wanting free stuff. But, you know, some things over time due to market progress have become free, like education, information is free. Communicate, you know, essentially free. All you have to do is have an internet connection. Communication is essentially free because of, you know, technological advancement. You know, we can, it used to be, you know, like $1 a minute to make international calls. Now it's, now you can do it free, and you can do it with a video too. You can actually, you know, my family here, we've got family in Kenya. We have face-to-face conversations with them for free, you know, just the cost of a cell phone plan. So it's really amazing. You know, people keep putting their hopes in government when, you know, all the evidence is to put your hopes into freedom.
Yeah.
Well said.
Well, I think we should end it there and get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive bonus content, which is available for Patreon supporters. So thanks again, Jared. And people can find your article at libertarianinstitute.org, and your other websites are Breaking Liberty and Anarcholand. And of course, our site is actualanarchy.com/199 for the show notes and more for our discussion on Hotel Rwanda. And we will be back next week talking about some more of The Godfather with great Keith Knight of Don't Tread on Anyone. And we will see you guys all then. Until then, maximum freedom. Peace out.
The Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the Chipmunks, guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.